morning. Good morning. Hey, we're in this series we just started last week called It's Go Time, because God is a God of go. He says it a lot. You read it a lot. As a matter of fact, 1,300 times in the Bible, the word go is there. Sometimes it's telling a story, and that person decided to go. Sometimes those serve as examples. Other times it's an imperative. God tells us to go. He asks us to go. He challenges us to go. God is a God of go. He says it a lot, and he actually does it a lot. God shows initiative. In the beginning, God. Like the very first four words of the Bible, God is initiating. He's going. He's doing something. And if you're a follower of Jesus, that implies movement, going, following. It's go time. It's time to move. As a matter of fact, the goal of this series, really, I think if we take seriously God's challenge for us to go, we'll do three things for us. I think it'll help us know God better, develop a deeper faith, and help us discover God's purpose for our life. Last week, we talked about God's great go in Matthew 28, the Great Commission, where he says to his followers, go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. We talked about how God challenges us to go make disciples, make other followers and learners of Jesus. For you, wherever you show up on a Monday morning, that's where you go. God is sending you there to be his ambassador, his representative, to go and represent him well, tell others about him. So wherever you show up on Monday morning, that's your Monday morning mission field. But he also challenges to go to all nations. Well, we're not going to have a bucket list of, I want to go visit every nation and make a disciple. Like, we can't all do that, but we can do something to be participating with God's great mission and his heart for the nations. Sometimes that's actually going someplace for a short time, or maybe even for a career change or a lifestyle change. Sometimes it's being sent, sometimes it's sending others, helping others go. Sometimes it's welcoming as the nations come to us in different ways. But God has a heart for the nations, and he challenges us to go and make disciples. Don't just keep it to yourself, and don't always just stay where you are. Take some steps of following him to go. The rest of the series, we're going to get real practical and talk about how it impacts our relationships, our leadership, conflict. And I think, again, as we do this, we're going to understand that God quite often will tell us to go, to do something. Sometimes we want something to change, but we're not willing to change ourselves. We'll stay where we are and do what we're doing and wait for something to come to us. But God often says, no, I need you to go and go where I send you. Well, today I want to talk about kind of how in life we have go-tos in life. You have go-tos in life. For instance, you probably have a go-to restaurant that you go to, like, hey, where should we eat tonight? You probably say one restaurant more than others. And it's okay to talk in church. What is your go-to restaurant when you go? Wendy's, Alboron's, Chick-fil-A, Outback, Raising Cane's, Taco Bell. One guy, yes. So for my son, John, his go-to is Rosa's. He knows the the people there behind the counter so well, he gets a VIP discount if the right people are working, which I'm thankful because he has a go-to order at his go-to restaurant. 4 bean and cheese burritos with extra cheese, a large queso with no chips, a Coke, and now he's added a dozen tortillas to also dip in his queso. He's a growing boy. And we have a shrinking bank account. We've eaten there 6 times this week. When we showed up yesterday, John, what happened? The guy starts entering in his order. Like, he knows it. 4 bean and cheese burritos, large queso. Like, that's how it is. You probably have a go-to order wherever you go to when it's time to go out. Chick-fil-A, number one, large unsweet tea. You want your fries large as well? Probably shouldn't, but I'm going to say yes. That's my go-to order there. You have go-to orders. You probably, let me ask this, any Gatorade drinkers in the house? A few? Okay, you probably have a go-to flavor with Gatorade. Yesterday, we had the high sacred honor and duty of bringing snacks to the basketball games for both my son and my daughter. So we were on snack duty twice. Very important role. I decide it's basketball, we'll get Gatorade, and I'll give them a choice. There'll be 2 flavors, grape and blue, because apparently blue is a flavor. So I get 6 grape, 6 blue. I put them on the table. I hope we have enough grape. They come up, hey, what flavor do you like? Blue. Blue's not a flavor. Here you go. What flavor would you like? Blue. Blue's not a flavor. What flavor would you like? Blue. Blue's not a flavor. Like, I'm trying to teach them, but also I'm going, well, there's going to be a lot of grape left for me. That's my favorite. This is good. But I didn't think about the people who got to the end and go, grape, that's all you have left? I wanted blue. It's not a flavor. So let me just ask, in the room, who likes grape? If you had the choice, if you were showed up at snack time, who likes grape? Who likes blue? Blue's not a flavor. It's not a flavor. But God allows a lot of grace for those who wander off the path. That's okay. What other go-tos? You probably have a go-to song that you listen to more than any other. Sometimes it changes. My go-to song, Don't Stop Believing by Journey. When I want to get pumped up, I listen to it. If it comes on the radio, or if it kind of shows up on my playlist, whatever's happening that moment, I assume it's go time. Whatever it is, it's go time. Like, I just have this extra little burst of energy. You probably have a go-to hobby, something you do whenever you have a little downtime. I got a little downtime. What should I do? I'm going to watch Netflix. I'm going to read a book. I'm going to, whatever it is. You probably have a go-to beverage. I'm not going to go too much into that, but you probably have a go-to beverage. Like, mine's large unsweet tea. That's my go-to. Like, we have go-to things in life. We have go-to vacations. Hey, what do you want to do on vacation this year? You probably tend to go to the same type of experiences. Like, you might be a beach person or a mountain person. I've asked this question before. How many of you are beach people? All right. How many of you are mountain people? Man, God shows a lot of grace for those who wander off the path. And why would you go up there? Less oxygen, no trees. Like, people die on Mount Everest. They don't die on the beach. They die of sharks in the water. But beach is a good place to be, right? Like, anyway, I'll let you go off the path that way if you want. But we have go-to vacations. You have go-tos in life. And the reason you need to know that about yourself is not so you don't go to the same restaurant all the time, although that would be okay, John, if we went to other restaurants from time to time. It's okay to do that. Here's why you need to know that about yourself. You have go-tos in other areas of life too. When you're lonely, you have a go-to. When you're stressed, you have a go-to thing for relief. When you're angry, you have a go-to strategy. When you are looking for something to fulfill you, you have go-to things or people that may or may not be best for you. In fact, what we want to talk to is really you were designed to have one go-to strategy in life to meet your needs and desires. But too often we look to something else, and us choosing for Jesus to be the go-to in our life doesn't just impact our life, it has impact on others. So if you have your Bibles, turn to John chapter 6, the Gospel of John. It's in the New Testament. Kind of go down the middle, but shoot to the right. Two-thirds of the way through the Bible. So it's the New Testament. It's Jesus and after. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the four Gospels. The good news of Jesus, it tells the story of his life. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are three of those Gospels. They're very, very similar, but written by three different people to give an account. They're very similar, though. John is very different. John is like, he was like the inner disciple. Like, he was like the right-hand guy for Jesus. Like, it's like if your college roommate wrote your life story for the college years, he had that kind of insight. Like, some of you, that made you nervous right there, right? Like, I hope nobody writes that story. Like, but John, like, he knew Jesus really well. And he gave a very personal inside kind of look into Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. In John chapter 6, it's a very strategic chapter as you're reading the story of Jesus and John, because in John chapter 6, everything up to this point is it's a party. It's crowds. People are loving being a part of Jesus. The disciples are like, hey man, we're with Jesus, and everyone loved them for that. Well, most people. In John chapter 6, it turns from a party to a partying. People start leaving following Jesus. And it creates some tension in the life of the 12 disciples, because they're like, what are we going to do? So in this passage in John chapter 6, when it says disciples at the beginning, it's talking about all the crowd who were learning from Jesus. It's not just the 12 disciples, it's the big crowd of people. And here it is in John chapter 6, verses 60 and following. On hearing it, many of his disciples, big crowd, said, "This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it? Well, what was it? What was, on hearing it, what was the it that was a hard teaching that was hard to accept? Well, several things. One, Jesus had started talking about who he was and his role as the Messiah. And they thought, I thought you were going to be somebody different. I thought you were going to play a different role in our life. I thought you were going to liberate us from Rome and you were going to be the conquering hero and Israel's going to be back on top again. I thought you were going to be, Jesus, I thought you'd play a different role in my life than you're playing. Some people thought, I thought you would ask something different of me. I didn't think you would ask me to die to self or to deny myself and take up my cross and follow you. I didn't think you would tell me to put others first before myself. I didn't see that coming. I liked the feeding the 5,000 and the big party that was. I'm not sure. And then, so Jesus feeds the 5,000 and then he tells everybody, I'm the bread of life. And if you don't eat of my flesh, you won't live. And all of a sudden they're going, that's gross. Like, I don't know what you mean by that, but that sounds gross. That sounds like cannibalism. So all of a sudden they hear all this stuff. And on hearing all that, thinking, I thought Jesus would be someone different than he's going to be for me. I thought he wouldn't ask as much of me as he's asking. All that stuff going on, they said, that's hard. Sometimes Jesus is going to ask something of you that's very hard. And you're going to ask, who can accept that? Who can do that? What you're really going to ask is, can I accept that? Can I do that? They start asking this question. Then, and here's the truth about this. Here's why you need to know that that's true in you, that sometimes you're going to have that tendency to kind of push back on Jesus and go, this is hard. And he knows what's going on. Sometimes in life, you're going to experience things that challenge us to the point of going to other things other than Jesus to be life for us. You're going to choose other go-to things to be life for you when you're lonely, when you're scared, when you're in want or need. You're going to look for other things to be the go-to, to be the leader and the king of your life. It's just, that's the nature of how we're kind of, what's true for all of us in terms of this broken identity we have. And sometimes it even happens from God himself. God asks something of you or he teaches something to you and you go, that's hard. Who can accept it? And you start finding yourself wanting to step back from him being your leader. You need to know that's true of you because it's true of me. Just like it's true of them, it's true of all of us. We have this dangerous tendency to go to other things to be life. And Jesus knows that. And he calls them on it. But he does it with grace. And he says, I know what you're doing here. And he kind of pushes back on them. And he challenges them in verse 61. Aware that his disciples were grumbling about this, they weren't kind of going, I don't know what I think about that. Like they were grumble, grumble, whatever that sounds like. They were grumbling. So he says to them, does this offend you? Then what if, and this was a preview of what would happen after the cross and the empty tomb at the very end, and Jesus saying, hey, you think it's hard to follow me when I'm here? What about when I'm not here? But you're following the Holy Spirit as he leads through you. And they have no idea to understand, even wrap their heads around that. But he goes, what if, just perhaps off the top of my head, the Son of Man ascends to where he was before? The Spirit gives life. The Holy Spirit gives life. The flesh, like your, what, our point of view, our thinking, our old, the way we used to be before Jesus, that counts for nothing. The words I have spoken to you, they are full of the Spirit and life. He goes, what I'm telling you, and who I am to you, this is life. And he pushes back on the grumbling of his followers, of the whole crowd. He's aware of it, and he engages them, not to shame them and say, how dare you? But say, are you going to waver, or are you going to follow? What are you going to do? And he's exposing this tendency that's not just true for them, it's true for you. At some point in your life, he's going to ask something of you, and you go, I don't know about this. I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I want to do it. I don't know if I understand. The truth is, think about this. They just saw him perform this huge miracle of feeding thousands of people. And they're all going, this is amazing. We're with Jesus. We're with Jesus. This is awesome. Everyone's like, this is the greatest thing ever. All of a sudden they go, I don't know. It's a cool party trick, but I don't know if I can really trust you to be life for me. Like they could miss it. It could happen to any of us. That Jesus can be life for you and even get a taste of it. And then later on go, I don't know, and miss it. And it goes on to say this in verse 64. Yet, Jesus is talking, yet there are some of you who do not believe. For Jesus had known from the beginning which of them did not believe and who would betray him. He's talking about Judas, one of the 12, one of his disciples. He knew from the beginning, he's going to sell me out and I'm going to be hurt, abused, ridiculed, and ultimately die a very painful death. And he's going to be the one that hands me over. Yet he loved Judas and included him for 3 years knowing that. Man, that'd be a tough thing to do. And Judas is obviously wavering. But I think it was more than just someone like that. I think all of them were going, I don't know about this. He went on to say, this is why I told you that no one can come to me unless the Father has enabled him. And then it says this, adds this little commentary. From this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. Huge crowd gets really thin. No more crowded venues. No more having to worry about feeding 5,000 because there aren't 5,000 people there. One of the translations of this, from this time, many of his disciples, the followers, went back to their old associations. This is what happens for us. When we waver and look for other things to be life, we go back to what we used to know, what we used to do, who we used to be. And that happens here. Many turned away. It's common. You're not immune to this. You need to know this. You're not immune to this. I'm not either. Verse 67, he turns from the crowd who are leaving and he turns to the 12 who I wonder if at this point they're not going, kind of going, I don't know about this. As the crowd's leaving, he turns and kind of gets their attention and says, you don't want to leave too, do you? Jesus asked the 12. Again, he was talking to the disciples, the big crowd. Now it's the 12, his 12 disciples. He looks right at them and he goes, you don't want to leave too, do you? And at this point, I wonder if someone were like, well, I do kind of get where they're coming from. And here's the nature of us. We are designed to be followers. We are. We follow the crowd. And we're designed to be followers because ultimately we're designed to be a follower of Jesus. But sometimes we will follow things other than Jesus, that it has influence in our life. And we need to know that we have a tendency to follow the crowd. That's why many of us buy blue Gatorade because somebody marketed it well. And you will follow the crowd who buys blue Gatorade as off, you know, it's not a color, it's not a flavor, it's blue. But we'll follow, you know, I'll buy that because somebody else did. I'll say that because somebody else did. I'll buy that because somebody else did. I will choose that because somebody else did. Like, we are followers. It's just who we are. That's why the Bible oftentimes calls us sheep. We were designed to follow, though. But it's important to remember who we were designed to follow. So the 12 are now, I think they're wavering. I think they're looking at the crowd and going, we're not as popular anymore. Because now they're kind of against Jesus. Before, they were pretty impressed that we were holding the baskets of food when everyone was being fed on the hillside, when 5,000 are miraculously fed. Now they're leaving. Do we want to leave too? I think they're asking themselves that question. And it says that Jesus asked the 12, but one guy speaks up. Hey guys, I got this. I don't think they voted, hey Peter, would you just speak for us now? Or Peter was just that guy like, oh, pick me. Like, he was always wanting to give the answer. I don't think he had permission from the others, but he speaks up for the 12 and he says this, guys, I got this. Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We, us 12, that this one is speaking for, have come to believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. He steps and goes, who else can we go to? Who has promised the kind of things that you have promised? And even more importantly, who has delivered on promises in the past like you have? No one else can do that. There are some things and some people in life that whether it makes the promise or we feel like it offers promise, we will look to other things to be life. And if you compare it to Jesus, nothing makes those kind of promises like Jesus does. Nothing and no one. And even more importantly, no one has delivered and will continue to deliver the way Jesus says and will with his promises. Nothing else can offer life like Jesus can. Here's the tension. If you're a follower of Jesus, you're probably like, yeah, I agree. Peter, yes, speak up. Speak for me because I agree. Of course, like, I know the answer. The answer is Jesus. I know that Jesus is the one. We would answer the same as Peter. Here's the warning. You can know that's true, You can believe that's true, but still have this propensity to go to other things to be life. We're designed to be followers, but we're broken, and a lot of times we look to the wrong things to be life. That's not just a new thing in this day. It was true in the disciples' day. It was true even before that. The book of Psalms talks about this tendency for us to let other things have our affection and our attention. And whatever gets your affection, attention, and priority shapes your direction, and it ends up shaping you. In Psalm 115, verses 1 and following, it says this: "Not to us, Lord, not to us, but to your name be the glory." Like, God, you should be the center of it all. You should be the center of attention. You should be the top priority. Everything is about you. It's all created by you. It's all created for you. It's all about you because of your love and faithfulness. What you offer, what you promise, no one else and nothing else can deliver. You should get all the credit, all the praise. You should be number one. But why do the nations say, where is their God? Our God is in heaven. He does whatever pleases him. He's in charge. But here's what we do. We look to other things to be God in our life. But their idols, other people, but it's true of us too, their idols are silver and gold and made by human hands. I know that probably today, no one's at risk of going home and whittling out a new God. No one's going to go home and say, let's get all the silverware together, melt it down, and build a little God statue and worship that. That's not what we're going to do. Idols are not a statue. Idols are anything you say that is priority for me. That gets my attention, my affection, my devotion, my finances, my thoughts, my life. It influences me. That's what an idol is, okay? Anything that gets priority that's not God. And here's why they're limited. They cannot fulfill what Jesus can offer. They have mouths but cannot speak, eyes but cannot see, ears but cannot hear, noses but cannot smell. They have hands but cannot feel, feet but cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their throats. They look like they can offer something, but they ultimately can't do it. Only Jesus can. Verse 8, here's why it's important to know what that is for you. Those who make them, those who look for something else to be their God, to be their priority, will be like them. You'll become like it. It will shape you. So will all who trust in them. It will get your trust. For 12 years, I was a hockey chaplain and helped set up hockey chapels with teams, and I got to work with, at the very highest level, like NHL players on down through the minors and even with kids. And one thing I noticed about professional athletes, and it's true in any sport, is when you get to be a professional athlete, you are doing the thing you dreamed about as a kid doing. And only, I remember my friend Paul Allen is a chaplain in Canada for an NHL hockey team at the top level, and he was doing chapel one day, and he knew this about the guys in the room. He knew that they're making more money than they ever thought possible. They are getting any date they want. They are have an identity where they walk in, even though they have more money than probably anyone in the room, they're not having to buy their food or their soda pop. Like they're getting it all. They don't have to buy blue Gatorade. It's provided for them. Like they've got everything. And so much so that it becomes their identity, their community, and their thing that they put their trust in. And they're living out their childhood dream. And he had this great line in chapel one time. I've never forgotten what he said. He looked at me, he said, "Hockey is a great sport, but it's a terrible God. You dreamed of doing this your whole life. It's giving you more than you ever thought it could give. But ultimately, it will let you down. You will reach the end of your career, the end of your finances. Your community will go away, your identity." And I have a friend who played for a team, and he knew it was coming. He told me, he said, "Doug, one day I'm going to go home, and they're not going to say, this is so-and-so who's a hockey player, plays for the so-and-so, this team, a hockey player. They're saying, this is so-and-so who used to be a hockey player." My friend, when he left as being a pro athlete, his wife left him. His life fell apart. And he saw it coming. He goes, "I know one day all of this will go away. Hockey is a great sport, but it's a terrible God." You are not hockey players. How does this apply to you? Your job, for all the security it provides, all the identity it provides, all the community it provides, everything your job provides, everything that school provides, everything your sport, if you play a sport, provides, everything your talent, whatever it is, it's a great, whatever it is, it's a great job, it's a great sport, it's a terrible God. It is limited and what it can do for you, for your identity, your provision, your community, and for providing life. Your relationships, they're great. You're designed for relationships. God created relationships. Your marriage, God designed marriage. He's the best resource for it because he put it together. It's a gift from him. But your marriage is a terrible God. If you worship it and put it above God, something's going to break. Your dating, your friendships, they're great. You were not created to do life alone. But if it becomes your God, it's a terrible God, and you'll find this out at some point. It will let you down. It will not deliver where you need it most. Fill in the blank with anything there. It's great, but it's a terrible God. And Peter knew this because only God is uniquely qualified to be God. In John 6, he said, "Whom shall we go?" Only God is uniquely qualified to be God. Let Jesus be life for you. He is the key to life, but he is life. And he was designed to be priority and at the center of your life. The challenge for us is we will look to other things. So let God be God. The great truth in life, there is a God, and it's not me. It's not you either. But there is a God who loves you, who gave his life for you so he could give his life to you. And when he's in charge, he walks with you through everything and leads you like no one else can and delivers like no one else will be able to and nothing else will be able to. And one guy speaks up for the 12. "Guys, I got this." He puts his hand back and says, "Guys, hang on, I got this." And he speaks up. And I wonder if this was a tipping point for them. Like if some of them were wavering, like, "Well, I don't know." But Peter goes first. What we know from the rest of the story is the others followed. Sometimes all it takes is for someone to go first. There's a great story. I love telling this story about the Battle of Bunker Hill. It happened at the beginning of the Revolutionary War. America was 13 colonies. They weren't yet united. They had fought the Battle of Lexington and Concord, the first couple of battles. There was a siege on Boston, the colonials, even though they were outnumbered by the British, which was amazing. Number one powerhouse in the world military-wise. And they were trying to break away from them. They put a siege on Boston to try and keep resources from coming in. A key part of that was that little strait of water right there, and they wanted to own that. And so what they did is across the bay from Boston, or the strait from Boston, is Charlestown. That's where the Battle of Bunker Hill was fought. A little trivia. Where was the Battle of Bunker Hill fought? Anyone, any idea? Well, yeah, Charlestown, I just said that. But like, where was the Battle of Bunker Hill fought? It wasn't fought at Bunker Hill. It was fought on Breed's Hill. So either, as we're sometimes prone to do, we showed up in the wrong place and fought for the wrong hill. There's a metaphor in there somewhere. And we have the kind of the weird thing about fighting on the wrong hill. But I really, history tells us, it was probably a strategic move where they got up there and go, actually, Breed's Hill would be a better thing than Bunker Hill to fight, but it's still called the Battle of Bunker Hill. They were all kind of right there together. So what happened, here's what's going on. They've got the siege, and they heard through spies, the Americans did, the colonies did, that the British were going to take the high ground in Charleston to kind of secure and try and break through the siege. So they heard it from the spies, and they knew, no, we've got to take the high ground, because they learned from another lesson in history. Obi-Wan Kenobi, take the high ground, Anakin. I have the high ground. So the other thing there. So they decide, okay, we got to get up there before them. So at 9 p.m., they decide, let's all go up and take Breed's Hill, or Bunker Hill. But they end up taking Breed's Hill. So they're quietly going up, like they're like ninja, like, hey, let's play the quiet game. And they're moving up and trying to get up there. They get up and they start digging real quietly all night long. And they dig this fortification 130 feet by 130 feet where they dig down and they take the dirt they're digging out and build up walls all the way around at the high ground up there. Kind of, you can see it on the right side of the map. Well, if you'll notice on the left side of the map, there's a lot of fire. Here's what happened. The British wake up and go, oh no, that's not a direct quote. But they look at them and they go, oh no, they've got the high ground. Remember what Anakin or Obi-Wan said? And so they go, we got to take the high ground. So they start firing cannon fire up there, shooting uphill. It's very inaccurate. Inaccurate, unaccurate. It doesn't work very well. You don't have good aim. So they go, well, let's try and, we can't scare them that way. let's try, what can we do to kind of make them leave? Let's start shooting at their homes. Let's start shooting at the church. And then this is what really broke them. Let's start shooting at the tavern. So they start shooting at the town. And it really, like, that's even what they said. When they start shooting at the church and tavern, our wills started to break. They're ruining our town. It's up in flames. So everyone's kind of getting a little nervous. And then Asa Pollard, who is one of the colonials, is sitting behind the barricade, and he kind of pokes his head up, and a lucky shot from a cannonball comes right and catches Asa Pollard between the eyes. He's the first casualty, and he no longer needed hats after that day. He lost his head, literally. Cannonball takes his head right off. They see, they're burning our houses. Asa Pollard just lost his head. They're like, hey, I borrowed this shovel from a friend, and I need to take it back. I told him I'd have it back by 9. I got to go. And everyone starts wanting to leave. And they're already outmanned, outgunned. Like they don't have much of a chance as it is. But they've got the high ground and they've got the position. But they don't have the confidence. And they start backing off and trying to leave. And some are start deserting. And then a guy named William Prescott, this is kind of a picture of what it looked like. He gets up. Oh, I forget. This is so great. So General Gage is down on the ship. When they get up in the morning and go, oh no, it's not a direct quote. Oh no. They look at it. And he goes, who is that up there leading them? Because whoever led the army at any little group was always very key. And they all kind of knew each other. Like, remember, the British were living here for a while, and they'd fought some different engagements together. So the guy, General Gage, goes, hey, who is that guy? And the guy next to him was Abijah Willard, who was William Prescott's brother-in-law, like in-laws, right? And he goes, they're on different sides, and he's a loyalist. And he goes, that's my brother-in-law. And General Gage asked him, will William Prescott fight? He goes, I can't speak for his men, but he will fight you to the gates of hell. Okay, so you're saying he's going to fight. All right, so they get down, and they start advancing up. And William Prescott gives this great line. He tells them, and whether it's not, it's true, or someone just kind of crafted it later or whatever, he says, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. It was a strategic difference. We're going to wait till they're close enough where you can see what color eyes they have, and then we're going to let them have it. Because the reality is, we don't have enough bullets. We don't have enough people. They've got more than us of both, people and bullets. So he gives that order, but everyone's starting to leave. So he doesn't just give the order. He stands up on the edge of the barricade. He stands up, and he looks at his men, and he puts his hand back. And this is the statue of the monument of Colonel Prescott there on the right. He's got his hand back to his men saying, stand your ground. Stay here. And he looks down at the ship and says, try and hit me. Try and hit me. Asa Pollard would say that's a bad idea. Didn't go so well for him. But they have terrible aim. They can't get it to where they can hit him. So he's standing there. His men are like, well, look at his bravery. So they start moving up, and they start kind of taunting, and they're kind of all lined up now. And then the British go, all right, we're doing this. So they move up the hill the first wave. Wait till you see the whites of their eyes. They get close. Bang, they let them have it. So the British go back. Second wave, they start marching up. Bang, they let them have it. And they go back. Third wave, they're marching up. They're like, this is weird. Like, the whites of my eyes are visible now. Why aren't they shooting me? All of a sudden, a guy goes, ow! He gets hit with a rock. Then they go, ow! That guy threw his gun at me. They're out of bullets. So they charge. And Colonel Prescott, who's saying, guys, stay here, now he says, you guys go. He starts fighting people off with his sword. Like, they're lunging at him with a bayonet, and he's parrying with his sword. That's a thing you do with a sword, I guess. Like, he's jabbing in there, and he's one of the last people to leave as they retreat. The British actually won the Battle of Bunker Hill that was fought on Breed's Hill. But what happened that day is the British had twice as many casualties. And the British that day learned, if they ever get organized, we're in big trouble. They're a lot more competent than we thought. They want this a lot more than we thought. And the colonies learned, if we were, rather than 13 colonies, we were one army, and they put a leader in charge named George Washington. If we could ever get organized, and they did, we could win, and they did. And that's why today, you don't have to drink tea this afternoon. We don't have tea time anymore, thanks to that little thing back in 1775. We won the war, ultimately. But all this happened. This battle would have gone so different if William Prescott didn't stand up and say, guys, I got this. We're staying here, and you're not going to win. And when he did that, One person went first, and it changed the battle. Sometimes the only leadership that is needed is someone to go first. Go first. Don't wait for someone else to set out in a certain direction, because then you'll follow people who are going in the wrong direction. When you know what's the right thing to do, do it. Go first with kindness. Go first with humility. Go first with forgiveness. Go first with I'm sorry. Go first with compassion. Go first with following Jesus. Because chances are a lot of people will go the other way, but sometimes all it takes is someone going first for other people to follow Jesus too. What Peter said is, to whom should we go? Who else has the words of eternal life? You alone are the Holy One of God. And when you go first at putting Jesus first and following Him, even before, and for me, I'd usually say, Jesus, follow me. Because I tend to be pretty selfish. When I was in high school, I followed the crowd and made terrible choices. And it really had a devastating impact on my life and my family. And then I saw somebody following Jesus. And it changed me. And I gave my life to Christ. And then I ignored the Bible my whole life, so I thought, I was supposed to go to Texas Tech, but I'm going to go to a Bible college my first year because I've been ignoring the Bible forever. I want to learn this. I want to understand what I believe. So I went there. After the first year of Bible college, I was playing volleyball with some friends in the summer, and terrible way to make a decision. All my friends went to Texas Tech except two of us, one guy and me. And the other guy goes, in July, before school starts, I think I'm going to go to Texas Tech. And I said, I think I will too. Didn't pray about it, didn't think about it. I just said, I will too. I ended up at Texas Tech, very vulnerable time in my life. I start playing volleyball with my friends and intramurals and stuff. Our team name was Mr. Margarita, so we weren't making the best choices, but we won the Stangle Merdot Beach Volleyball Tournament, and I'm a champion. And so we do that, we do that, and I'm hanging out with them, and then my friend Tom McCray from high school, we weren't really close, but we knew each other, but he never followed the crowd. He always followed Jesus. And one day, we came across each other at Texas Tech, which is hard. It wasn't as big then, but it's a big school. And we crossed paths, and he goes, hey, you should go to church with me. I was like, yeah, I probably should. And I did. And it was at that church where I ended up serving as an intern with the youth ministry and ended up being an associate youth minister. And then that youth minister ended up planting Live Oak, and he was the senior pastor. And then I became the senior pastor for that guy. Like that one invitation, Tom going first at following Jesus in college changed me. Sometimes all it takes is for someone to go first. Jesus said it this way in Matthew 6:33, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Nothing else makes that promise. No, I take that back. Lots of things will make this promise. It'll get everything you want or desire. No, they can promise it, but only one can deliver. Jesus said, in me is life and life abundantly. No one else makes and keeps that promise like Jesus. So when it comes to your go-to in life, whatever your scenario, go to Jesus first. Go to putting Jesus first. Follow him. Let him be God and leader of your life. And as you go first, sometimes that's all it takes for someone else to follow. But even if they don't, following Jesus will shape you and change you and deliver like nothing else can. So what is your go-to like right now? And is it Jesus? Is Jesus your go-to for life? Is he in charge? Because it will make a difference for you and probably for others. Let's stand for closing prayer. God, thanks for Tom McCray, who just made a very simple invitation for me to go with him to church in a time where I was very much wavering. God, thanks that you want us to go first because it will have an impact on others. But a lot of times I see more of what's difficult or hard about it. Thanks for an example of Peter who went first, not just in what he said, but how he believed and lived, how he sacrificed everything for you. God, thanks for Tom McCray being that example for me. I pray you'd use me to be an example for like that for others, and you'd use us in this room to go first, because sometimes that's all it takes is to go first in doing what you ask and doing the right thing. And I pray that it would impact others and give us the strength and courage to not always follow the crowd, but always to follow you. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen. If you'd like to talk, I'll be here at the front.
Thank you.